Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show.
Welcome to Roguecast, episode 234. It's a big week of comics.
It is.
There's a bit of news.
Yep.
And we're starting a little late, so we're going to just jump right into it. First of all, just want to mention that next week we will be closed for Thanksgiving, Thursday, November 22nd. It's one of the few days of the year we're closed. Yeah. And then that Friday, Black Friday, we do our annual, our 10th annual sale.
Oh, man.
Basically, every $25 you spend, you get $5 in gift certificates that you can then spend. You can give that out to people, or you can spend it for yourself.
Yes. So, for example, say you spend $100, you'll walk out with a $20 gift certificate.
That is correct. Also, you can do that on anything except you can't buy gift certificates to get gift certificates.
Right.
That's a game in the system. We don't allow it.
Yeah.
But, okay. On to the news. The big news, of course, is...
Sad news.
And that is that Stan Lee has died at the age of 95, which, man, that's a good run.
It's a good run.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, sometimes I'll think about some of my favorite creators, like John Carpenter.
Yeah.
And there's a guy who, like, in the 80s, he did all his kind of his best work, but it was very hard for him to get a hit and get really recognized. But he has lived long enough to be recognized for it. Now, he's a cranky old curmudgeon, and I don't know if he fully appreciates it.
Right.
But I was glad at least he made it. Stan has had decades of being kind of acknowledged as, like, the... Like Uncle Comics, basically.
Yeah, he definitely built up the sort of the huckster personality a little bit. It worked out for him.
And
seeing the MCU sort of grow.
Yeah, I was going to say, in the last 15 years in particular, really since they started with the cameos, even before that, he was the one comic creator who I suspect even our like family members who don't know about comics.
Oh, yeah. They
probably
knew about
like knew about that you could bring an X-Men and they're like, did Stan Lee write that?
Yeah.
And you're like, well, no, Mom, but his does say presented by Stan Lee on it.
Well, I mean, you go back to he was doing the voiceovers for Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. He'd be like, hey there, heroes.
Yeah.
So, he was already kind of like a voice in my head as a kid.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember, like, how did I know what he sounded like?
That was long before
I had ever met him. Just real quick roundtable, like, you know, Nick, do you feel like, you know, like, how big an impact?
I mean, of course he's gonna have an impact. I mean, he created so many, you know, like, iconic characters and, you know, shaped the way we look at superheroes and... by happenstance, the way we should look at the world.
Well, right. everybody's been sharing that Marvel, that one of his bullpen bulletins, you know, Stan soapbox things where he's talking about tolerance. And, you know, that was always there in those comics. And that was always like, I came in on like, what we're not, I had to read reprints of his comics when I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I would read old reprints of old Spider-Man stuff and I loved them. I recognize that they were from an era a little bit before me, and there might be some things that I might consider a little corny or whatever, but I loved them. And, what was I going to say? It's like, even the next generation and the generation after that, so, like, Roy Thomas was still a little before my time. Chris Claremont was, like, one of my first big writers, though, and I think he would be, like, considered, like, the third wave of Marvel writers.
Yeah.
But... that was still Stan's like kind of philosophy kind of still made its way into the X-Men, you know.
Well, Stan Lee was editor-in-chief for a long time, editor emeritus after that.
And also I just think like the impact of the style of those 60s comics, the you know, you were getting the first generation of fans turned writers and stuff in the 70s and 80s, and they had imprinted so hard on those that his lessons remained, you know, integral.
Yeah.
Changed and deepened, but...
There's always the controversies about whether or not Stan gave enough credit to his co-creators or sort of stole the limelight. And, you know, whatever.
I think that's it. There's fair discussion to be had there.
But the fact of the matter is that without Stan Lee... We saw what Jack Kirby created without Stan Lee, and we saw what they created together. And the two of them definitely both contributed.
Right.
And we saw what Stan created with other artists. Like, Stan Lee and Steve Ditko created Spider-Man. Kirby was not really involved in that.
Right.
I think he might have done one design sketch.
But there's no doubt that Lee and Ditko and Kirby, when they were working together, created better material than any of them would ever do separately.
Right.
Yeah. And that was just a magical era.
And they did. They were the creators of the Marvel Universe. Spider-Man, yep. Fantastic Four, Doctor Strange,
X-Men,
Iron Man, X-Men, everything.
Well, actually, they didn't create Cap.
No, they did not create Cap.
Or did Kirby co-create
him? Kirby
did. But like, it's almost ridiculous to imagine one person creating so much of an entire mega-fictional setting.
Black Panther was also Stan Lee in?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah. They're like, if
I don't know if he created the Falcon himself, but like he was, you know, what would, you know, we always want people to be more progressive than they were, mm-hmm. but he was about as progressive as you could be yep. for a comic writer for kids in the 60s.
If you look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe, 95% of the characters in there were Stan Lee creations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I guess the Guardians weren't.
And also, I mean, here's the thing about Stan is like, And I will also credit, like, Jack Kirby with these as well, but, like, there are ideas that are mind-blowing, like Galactus and the Silver
yeah.
Surfer.
Yeah.
That are both, I mean, like, I feel like that's, like, Grant Morrison's, his inspiration in a nutshell is something as ridiculous as a guy who flies around space on a surfboard.
Yeah.
But, like, ridiculously awesome. And a godlike planet eater who's above our morality and isn't even evil, and I'm yeah. like... That's some pretty heavy stuff for comics for kids or teens.
But didn't Lee also like the Celestials and?
I can't remember if he.
Because that would have been
was,
in.
That was Stan Lee as well.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
thing is, but all of Stan Lee's stuff had this message, whether it was somewhat simplistic, like Doctor Strange, who had to learn humility in order to become this right. sorcerer.
Peter Parker had to learn responsibility.
Yeah, you know, Peter Parker was the big one. I was going to... Obviously, yeah, Great yeah. Parker, responsibility is a thing that's, like, not just comics, but philosophy. That is that's an important thing.
Thor had to learn humanity.
There's a lot
and
of...
The X-Men would sort of teach tolerance.
Iron Man was also a story of yeah. Someone learning to be less selfish. All of his heroes had the sort of the feet of clay, but it was all about learning to... be human. It was about learning to be something bigger than yourself.
Yeah, overcoming your flaws.
Yeah, and just the fact that, I mean, you know, it's so taken for granted now, but that was simply, heroes with flaws was simply not something that was really done before then.
Yeah.
This notion that Peter Parker couldn't pay his bills, man, every, like, superhero before that was, like, some independently wealthy guy, mm-hmm. or they would be, like, kind of a cop or something like that. Right. But they tended to be these... You know, well-off, well-to-do people who...
They wouldn't even cover something as small as paying your bills or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
That wouldn't even be a
that'd
thing.
That'd be ridiculous.
I mean, that's the thing. If you look back, you can't argue that the Marvel Universe were the first superheroes. So you got to look at Superman and Batman.
Right.
And then going back to the fact that...
He was the first modern superhero.
But without Stan Lee, the superheroes we know now never exist.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And, yeah, and he was formative. And seeing the outpouring of you know, sympathy and condolences and loss from everyone yesterday was pretty powerful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, it was fascinating because, like you said, even people who are not as immersed as we are were, like, really felt it.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it, and I'm like, you know, I've joked about this before and talked about it, but, like, yeah, Marvel Comics were kind of my Bible growing up.
Yeah.
Or what the Bible is to other people. And, you know, it's like there are morality plays and action and adventure and all this stuff. And I feel arguably not the genocide and misogyny that you might find in that. Although, again, you can look at anything going back a little ways and you will find you'll find some things that are not very progressive now.
Yeah.
But yes, I was like, I'm like so glad that I kind of built my morality on what Stan Lee, on the bedrock that he, or the foundation
yeah,
he laid.
I did too. That's the Marvel Comics universe.
As crazy as it is to think about
it. That is my Bible, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty notable thing. So, yeah, like I say, 95, that's a good run. We all knew this was coming. He's been sick. There was the whole scandal about whether or not he was suffering some abuse.
Yeah, yeah, or having, you know, like, yeah, finances, just kind of some sort of embezzlement or financial blackmailing or something going on. And I was never fully up to date on that. I'm sure more will come to light now,
yeah.
too, probably. But I do hate the notion that he had that kind of ugliness going on in his last few years.
Me too, but the thing you got to look at is that Stan Lee basically got to see the rise of superhero movies and got to be a part of it.
Yeah.
He got to see...
In the biggest way possible.
He got to see his characters come to life and become an international phenomenon in a way they'd never been.
Mm-hmm.
He got to see that all those things have been successful and see what they meant to everyone. I think that's really... you can't ask for much better than that.
Yep.
And we still have a few more to come because he did film a few more.
What was interesting is, like, Stan is known as a huckster, and I recognize that this is part of kind of, like, his presentation of himself, but he also broadly presented himself as a humble guy.
Yeah.
Even if sometimes he did mock humble, he's like, oh, I just created a few characters, you know?
Yeah.
But yes, he always, you know, his genial presence, however much it was affected or built up or not, what felt real to us.
Right.
And just listening to all the stories that we've seen come out, since his death, about the time he took with people at conventions and to actually talk with them and the kids and things like that. I mean, he was a genuine, nice individual.
Right.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. It's sad, but I don't feel devastated because I do feel that I'm glad for that he got to live the life he did.
Yeah.
And got to see it all.
And his work will continue in areas.
Well, and unlike a lot of the people he worked with, which I think is one of the sticking points, he reaped the financial rewards of his creations too. Like he definitely had a position at Marvel for all his life.
Right.
Like he definitely lived a good life. All right. Moving on to other stuff. There was a teaser for Toy Story 4, which I think I'm the only one who got a chance to watch it.
Yeah, I did not get a chance to watch this.
So the slightly weird thing for me is I probably would have watched it, but I have held out on seeing Toy Story 3 for no good reason whatsoever. Just never gotten around to it.
That's not held out. That's
10 years old.
I would have believed you if you had said more.
That's not held out. That's just procrastination.
Yeah, sure. but I didn't want to spoil anything if they referred to events in it.
They did not. It is just a teaser. It is like a minute and a half long. It is basically all the characters sort of in a ring, holding hands and like singing. There's a little music, and then it shows this weird handcrafted fork thing with like pipe cleaner hair, yelling about how it's not a toy, it doesn't belong here, and it sort of knocks everybody off kilter, and then that is it. That's what it is.
It's some weirdo toy.
Yeah, some weirdo, some handmade kids toy.
Interesting.
So I am very wary of Toy Story 4. Toy Story 3 was a perfect ending. But I was wary of Toy Story 3, and I thought it was a perfect ending. So
yeah, yep.
I give them a lot of leeway.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, Toy Story is their crown jewel.
Sure.
I mean, they're not. I don't feel like they're gonna try to just milk the cash cow out of it. Honestly, yeah. I mean, yes, to some extent, that's what they do.
Right.
But I feel like that's one they're always
they
gonna
would be
put their
especially
A-game.
Protective of.
Yeah,
yeah. The recent example that I would kind of like to see it be better than would be Incredibles 2.
Yeah, which took so long to come out and then was disappointing.
Yeah. We had a joke. We were joking about the Toy Story trailer off mic or a few hours ago, actually, when you told me about it, Randy.
Yep.
And I will not go into my weird dark theory there. But the short version is, I did wonder if that toy is going to be like some kind of handcrafted toy from maybe a kid or something who cannot like afford the kind of fancy toys that they are always tied into. Which, by the way, going back to the original story, Toy Story concept, that was ingenious to build them around like these iconic licensed toys.
Right.
And like have a story to tell then about sort of more imaginative toys or the toys you build and things like that. I do think there's an interesting story to be told there. I'm not 100% sure if it fits with their approach, which is honestly to tie into licensed stuff. It'd be like doing a Lego movie about non-Lego toys. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that is my prediction based on your description of the teaser trailer I haven't seen.
That is that's great. That's
I'm willing to.
This is how religion starts,
Randy. My prediction can only be as good as your description.
Uh-huh.
So if my prediction is off, your description was crap.
Wow.
Yep.
All right. Okay.
So say we all.
The other trailer was the Detective Pikachu trailer.
Yep. I can't lie. It's a fun trailer. And the special effects were amazing. Honestly,
yeah.
I thought in it.
Yeah.
I was always going to have a problem with my archenemy Deadpool, a.k.a. Ryan Reynolds, a.k.a. Ryan Reynolds just sounding like Deadpool, doing the voice of Pikachu in it.
But it just sounds like Ryan Reynolds. You're bringing Deadpool into this.
Yeah. No, but like his, there's it has that snarky tone of all movies that are like from Pixar, Disney, stuff like that. And so Pikachu he doesn't have Deadpool's exact sense of humor, but there's still a little bit of that. I actually felt like it was a little bit more, what did I say, the Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane-y, kind of joking around and like, oh my god, you can hear me? You know, like, I felt like it could be, like, Peter Griffin could have been...
I did not get that vibe at all.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't mean naughty Seth MacFarlane. I just mean that it had that same kind of the goofiness that you see in the you might have seen in the trailers for Ted, minus the R-rated stuff.
Dave, I think like the Dark Jedi tree, this is what you brought in with you, because I did not get this, and you know I'm not a fan of Deadpool.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like Deadpool's infected.
How many times have you seen the Deadpool movie, Randy?
Three.
So you're slightly more of a fan than I am.
I mean, I feel like this might just come down to that you're not a fan of Ryan Reynolds.
No, I'm sure I could see Ryan Reynolds in another movie. Him kind of in quippy mode. Let me put it this way. I suspect, did Robin Williams ever do any other voice besides the genie for Disney?
Not that I know of. Not that I remember.
But if he had, like, voiced another character that was very unlike the genie, I probably would have been all right with it. If he had voiced another guy that kind of really played up that Robin Williams real quick, jumping around between different kind of personas and all that stuff like that, just like the genie, that probably would have bothered me a bit. Hmm. And I felt like Pikachu in this has a little bit of that snarky Deadpool vibe. Huh. I'm not saying it's the same thing. I'm just saying it's in the ballpark.
Yeah. This was not the reaction I had. I when we first heard about this, Ryan Reynolds playing Pikachu, I thought that was crazy.
Yeah.
I thought maybe there was, like, some kind of mix-up.
I had forgotten that he was doing it. That's why I was disappointed.
Oh, yeah. I've known this was coming for a year.
Yeah.
Well, I did not know that I was going to go see a Pokemon movie in theaters.
But this is, I mean, I really like the world of, like, there's Pokemon living alongside people. I love the idea that there's this one kid who, like...
He's like a failed Pokemon trainer.
He wanted to be a trainer, and then he discovers that he has this ability that was inside him all along to understand Pikachu in a way that nobody else can.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good premise.
I think the premise is good.
Randy, if I had talked to Randy of 5 years ago and said that you would say those words...
Oh, I would have told you were a crazy person. Like, what do I care about Pokemon?
Yeah, like, the lore of it all is kind of hilarious. It's hilarious that through Pokemon Go
is
we all have absorbed a baseline knowledge of Pokemon.
Yeah, but I really liked this. I thought this was a super fun trailer. I thought the special effects look amazing.
Yeah, the special effects are fantastic.
And I thought the jokes were funny. I liked it, so I'm looking forward to it.
What was I going to say? I had a friend who was posting something, and he's like, oh, they blew it. And he's like, I don't know how they, you know, didn't have Ash as the protagonist.
Was this friend's name Fave Darabee?
No. No, and I disagreed with him. I thought he made the wrong call that, first of all, there have been like a billion cartoons and at least a movie or two with Ash. Yeah. So why would you return to that well?
Yeah.
Also, of course, there's all sorts of reasons why, like, better to have a kind of attractive, what is he, teenager? He's like early 20s, right?
Yeah.
Attractive 20-something guy as the lead who's a new character who might bring in an audience you wouldn't otherwise rather than a 10-year-old kid. Although I guess you could have said it's Ash grown up. But they had a story to tell about a guy who Ash was all about, like, becoming the best Pokemon trainer from, like, starting from lowly beginnings and becoming big.
He wanted this to become the very best, like no one else around.
Correct. But this guy has a different story to tell. I was weirded out that he even thought that, because that seems like a kind of a clumsy thing to think that they should have done.
Yeah. Nick, what did you think?
I liked it a lot. I thought it was a fun trailer. The jokes landed for me. The special effects were great. I liked the cast. I mean, not only Ryan Reynolds. I like the kid. His name is Justice Smith.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I know anybody in this.
I don't think so. He was in The Get Down. Okay. He was also in Jurassic Park Fallen Kingdom.
Wait, Jaden Smith was in The Get Down.
His name is Justice Smith.
Am I wrong? It was Jaden Smith in The Get Down.
I don't think so.
It was Will Smith's kid. Then this is definitely Will Smith's kid.
I don't think... I mean, it's possible.
It was Will Smith's kid in The Get Down. I'm sure of that. And I thought it was Jaden Smith who was in that.
Well, he played Ezekiel in the Netflix series The Get Down.
Okay, I don't know. I'm confused now. I should look it up. I did remember seeing the name Smith, and I was like, wait a minute. Is this another Will Smith offspring?
It does not say that he is Will Smith's son.
Okay, well.
There could be another Smith who is not Will.
Smith is not a common name at all.
And also, I think, Ken Watanabe is somebody... I forget who he plays.
Is he voicing one of the Pokemon? Basically?
No, no, he actually is in the trailer somewhere. I don't know.
Is he the one talking to the lead guy?
It must have been.
Like, is it possible he's like the inspector or whatever, or the captain?
It might be. I think he's the captain.
Yeah.
If I had to guess.
And anyway, aside from the various his own story arc of he's trying to find out something about his missing, is his father missing or dead or what?
I couldn't quite get a handle.
I'm sure there's going to be some twists and turns about it, but it, you know, it seems like his father's at the very least has been missing for years. And there was also all these little sort of cameos by other Pokemon that you see.
The Mr. Mime one cracked me up. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
the Mr. Mime stuff
was
great.
Really,
but also just seeing like the Charizard and Bulbasaur, the stream of Bulbasaur walking through the forest.
Yeah,
it just seems like they've inhabited this world.
Nick, you and I know have watched a bit of the cartoon now and kind of know about those characters. And they actually, something they were very good at on the cartoon was eking out some emotion for them, even when they were just like saying the same thing over and over.
Well, they say their name.
They say their name, but they would find like, well, whoever the voice actress was, I think, who did Pikachu, found about a billion ways over time to express all these different things with it. The animals, the Pokemon were actually always very, very compelling in a sort of adorable way. And I think that they're going to, like, do a little bit of a slight ironic twist, or, like, they're going to have some humor about that, because Pikachu, I don't know what the explanation is going to be for, are they all saying things, but only this kid can understand them, or can he only understand Pikachu?
I think he can only understand Pikachu.
I think he can only understand Pikachu.
He's not going to understand, like, what a Bulbasaur is saying.
No.
Or is he? Like a Dr. Doolittle for Pokemon.
I don't think they're going to go to that.
I don't think so.
I think it's going to... I mean, I assume that all Pokemon can talk to each other, but they all have different dialects.
Yeah,
maybe?
I believe they used to have that where it'd be like, Pika Pika, Squirtle, Squirtle.
Yeah,
you know,
I
like
mean,
it would, like, it'd be ridiculous.
That's what they did on the cartoon.
Yeah. But anyway, my main point was just that all the cameos from all the Pokemon are going to be super fun, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So to be clear, Jaden Smith and Justice Smith are both in the Get Down.
Oh, okay.
Justice Smith plays, I think, the lead. Books is the lead character.
Yeah.
He was great. So that makes me more excited, because I actually really liked him.
Yeah, and he was good in Jurassic Park. I mean, it was kind of a bit role, but he was good in it.
All right. Moving on to, I think most of the rest of the stuff we got left is TV news. But it's interesting TV news. So a little bit more is coming about the Watchmen series that Damon Lindelof is doing for HBO.
Yeah.
Gene Smart... is playing, who I always love.
Yeah, Gene Smart's great.
Is playing an FBI agent who's tracking down the illegal superhumans. Her name is Agent Blake, which really makes you think of Edward Blake, the comedian.
Yep.
Like,
yeah.
And tying into the other news, Jeremy Irons is playing an older Ozymandias. So it seems like this is going to be the Watchmen sequel. That Doomsday Clock is a version of a Watchmen sequel. This is a different Watchmen sequel.
Right, it'll be like, well, Doomsday Clock, of course, had it was like both a Watchmen sequel and a What Happened If Watchmen Came Crashing Into the DC
and
Universe.
What's his name? The guy from A Brother Where Art Thou, and who's also in this, is playing a character named The Looking Glass.
Huh.
Oh. Which character from A Brother, or actor from A Brother?
He was also in Incredible Hulk. He played the Thinker. The big brain guy, the leader.
The leader.
Am I blanking on this guy's name?
I don't remember.
He's in a ton of stuff.
Armstrong.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Is it possible? So, like, if somehow that was the daughter of Edward Blake, now, aside from the fact that he seemed to sleep around a lot, the only kid we ever saw him with was the pregnant woman from Vietnam that he shot, and he, like, shot her in the stomach. Is there any crazy way that kid survived and grew up?
Not to become Gene Smart.
Okay, I don't know who Gene Smart. I don't know.
She is
like.
Very white.
Okay, not an
Tim
Asian
Blake Nelson
actress.
Is who I'm
Tim Blake Nelson.
Of.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
Okay, just checking. I think it would be if it is a kid, one of his a kid. It would be from some other liaison. Then
what's the hilarious? Here's the hilarious thing, Dave. Before you started talking about that, I was like, "Oh right, he did have a kid because there was that whole thing where he got Sally Jupiter pregnant, and of course that kid." Is
Laurie.
The main character of Watchmen.
Yes.
Yes.
I was like, oh, right, that kid we know about already.
To be fair, they do hold out that bit of information until, like, issue 11 or so.
And
the fact that, showing an older Ozymandias definitely implies, post-Watchmen events. I honestly continue to be a little bit more and more excited with each of these announcements. Me too. They all sound kind of interesting.
I'm curious who like Lou Gossett Jr. is going to be playing.
He's going to be playing his character from Iron Eagle, weirdly.
Regina King.
You know, they showed what happens when the Watchmen meets the DC Universe. What happens when they meet the Iron Eagle universe.
Like Regina King and Don Johnson.
Oh, that's weird. Maybe Louis Gossett Jr. will whip them into shape as a fighting force to go take on the 1980s Russians.
The evil Russians.
In their jets.
Yeah.
And Dr. Manhattan is like, you know, I could just turn them all into vapor, right? And he's like, I didn't hear that. I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that, son.
Get in that cockpit, get in the Dr. cockpit. Manhattan.
And Dr. Manhattan damn well better.
So this week, people, if you have seen the movie Iron Eagle, make sure and drop us an email. I have seen Iron Eagle.
I don't trust you if you haven't.
So I'm trying to remember, when does this hit? It's next year.
We don't
have a date yet.
No. So just real quick timeline thing. Jeremy Irons, not a young man.
Nope.
He's got some age on him.
Yep.
Going by the strict timeline of the comic, Ozymandias was like probably, I feel like he was like in his... by the time it was the 80s, I think he was in his... 40s or 50s. I think he was very young-looking, because I think they had showed him as far back as, the 60s there.
And you remember, Jack LaLanne, those guys, the bodybuilder types? They were older. When they were older, they were still in, really good shape. Jeremy Irons is no spring chicken. He's, 70 or 80.
Right. But I was just trying to figure out, does that roughly fit with the timeline of a guy who, if it's set in the present.
If it's 30 years later.
Yeah. That's probably about right. Honestly, if they needed him to be a little bit older, it's easier to probably put old age makeup on Jeremy Irons.
Jeremy Irons is 70 years old right now.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think he's
40, probably a pretty good fit for a well-preserved Ozymandias-like guy.
Yeah, I like it.
It definitely, this could still go south, but I like the choices they're making.
You know, this is interesting. Jean Smart's an older actress. She is also, I want to say, 50s or 60s.
But she's been getting around. She was in Legion.
You think that might be the original Silk Spectre or something?
I'm wondering if it's... Well, no, she's playing Agent Blake.
Oh, that's right. They said her.
I'm wondering if she's his sister.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
You know, he went CIA, she went FBI.
Could be.
I could totally see that.
Yeah, I could see that.
All we really know is we don't know anything about his family. We know that he was like a tough street kid in the 40s who beat up dudes on the the docks and stuff.
Yeah.
But they never said whether he did or didn't have family.
Yeah, he could have a younger sister who grew up to be an FBI agent.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. I'm excited about this and everything we hear. I can't wait to see
the first trailer for it.
Yeah. All right. We've heard another bit of what is now being called Disney Plus, the Disney streaming service. Which at last count had a Falcon Winter Soldier story, a Scarlet Witch and a Loki miniseries, and a Mandalorian series by Jon Favreau and a bunch of good directors.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They just announced a Cassian live action series. It's Cassian, the sort of rebel deep cover operative from Rogue One. Played by Diego Luna, who will be reprising the role.
Yep.
I think Dave, you and I were both more excited about this than we were about Mandalorian.
Yep. And I think. Most of my other friends were like, really? Because I'm more excited about The Mandalorian.
Which is kind of crazy because I know you guys don't really care for Rogue One or not, don't love it.
But the story, but Diego Luna's character was the character I liked.
Yeah.
His sort of darker, ends justify the means sort of operative.
But don't you think that's what they're going to be doing in this series? Is more darker?
That's what I want to see. I want to see that. But, yeah.
Kind of runs the end.
Yeah, they actually kind of honestly dropped that plot point a little bit in the movie.
Yeah.
Where it's like fairly early on, he does that very morally ambiguous thing, and then he's pretty straight up for the rest of it.
Yeah.
Beyond not telling her that he's supposed to assassinate her father.
Yeah, I want to see the more morally gray Cassian operative stuff. I like that idea. Yeah, so I'm all on board. That sounds great.
What I wanted, Rogue One to be was a little bit more heisty type stuff, more of a cool operation that went down. I was down with, conceptually I'm okay with the morally gray stuff, but I occasionally, were it a series, I would have liked to see the team pulling off certain jobs, destroy that supply depot when they go about it in a cool heisty A-team-ish way.
You mean like Solo?
No, not quite like that. These guys are the military unit, they are a rebellion unit, so it'd be more like, a Dirty Dozen kind of thing. They're... They're morally a little bit morally gray about what they're doing, a little terroristic maybe even, but they're doing stuff for the rebellion. Solo was heisting for, or at least they thought just for themselves.
And weirdly, I thought it was under the mind that Diego Luna's character Cassian worked by himself.
No, he was a rebel spy.
Yeah, but a singular spy. I mean, he definitely worked for the rebellion, but he was always ran solo.
They might even do something like that, although I assume he'll have a backup team and, like, a handler and...
Well, he seemed to be, like, a standard spy in that he would go in and create assets that use them, but,
so I was
like,
thinking
it's not
more,
an ensemble.
Thinking more of, like, a James Bond kind of feel to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, something like that was probably what I would guess, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if he's... He didn't quite strike me as the kind of guy who would have that sort of confidence and swagger as, like, sort of a spy like that. It did seem more like that kind of gritty... go undercover, sort of more almost Donnie Brasco style, like, in we need you to embed in them, and then, you know, or we need you to get, you know, a shipment of guns from these outlaws that we can use for the rebellion, but we're going to leave them high and dry. Like, I could be behind any of those interpretations, though. Even if it was a little more James Bond, I'd be okay with it. I just kind of generally like these notions.
Yeah. Yep.
So moving from gritty Star Wars to gritty Star Trek...
Mm-hmm.
Michelle Yeoh is in talks to devote to a Star Trek spinoff based on, is it Section 31?
Yeah, their sort of Black Ops Star Trek thing.
It's interesting. I have a Facebook friend who's a writer for, he's a fantasy writer and a sci-fi writer and writes for gaming and stuff. And he was actively disinterested in this. He's like, I don't want to see Dark Star Trek. And it's weird. I should be in the same place, but Michelle Yeoh is so good. I love the idea of the Federation recruiting the Empress of the Mirror Universe to basically help run their Black Ops division.
I think I'm closer to your friend.
Really?
Yeah. There's been two Star Trek projects announced recently that I don't have interest in. One is the animated thing, and the other one is this. It's more that, like Michelle Yeoh is could easily win me over, and I'll for sure allow for that.
Yeah.
I'm not even 100% sure I like the idea of Section 31 existing, though. In Trek's idealistic future, I don't necessarily want there to be a Black Ops CIA pulling dirty tricks and doing stuff like that. Doesn't quite feel very Star Trek. The Federation is supposed to be mostly the good guys.
Yeah, I guess I guess for some reason in the last couple of years I have a hard time picturing a utopian where someone isn't having to use these... more notorious methods to keep everyone else able to do the good, fight the good fight.
I guess what I'm saying is a show like that is almost feels necessarily 24-ish and kind of right-wing-ish.
I can see that.
When you get into ends justify the means territory, you can start veering kind of right-wing.
Yeah.
And I want my pristine socialist Trek utopian future.
Right. I get that. Michelle Yeoh is really the thing that makes me interested. I love her. I love the character she created.
Mm-hmm.
Or basically, she inhabited.
Like, we know that she is going to be around in the next season of Discovery.
And we're pretty sure it's going to be Section 31. We saw the bike badges.
Yep. What I was interested to see is, like, by the way, when Pike meets her, Pike last... I don't know that they'll... Everybody thinks she's dead, but they tried to, like, in the last episode or two, they kind of had... There was a Federation-wide sort of hoax from some insider people to make it be like... To suggest that she was still alive. They didn't say, oh, this is a mirror universe.
No, I'm pretty sure that she's basically stepped into her duplicate's life.
Yeah, that's what they did.
Yeah.
So do you think... So Pike, you don't think, is going to know initially,
no.
at least?
Nope.
I think the only one who's going to know is that Admiral that...
located, and of course Burnham.
Yeah, I think it's going to be just a select few of people.
Yeah.
Which again goes,
I feel
against
like
everything
since
Star
that was kind of a like Starfleet Command higher up decision to try that ruse because they were on the verge of losing the war with the Klingons.
Yeah.
But I feel like after that had been resolved, I don't know that there would be anything in them for to keep up the ruse because she would be so incredibly dangerous to simply say, oh yeah, you can just go back to being a captain. Yes, it's true, you overran a fascist society in the other world as its empress, but...
Well, that's why I don't think they're letting her go back to being a captain. I think they're like, well, we can't kill her because we're the Federation and we don't just murder people.
We can't
really imprison her. She helped us out of a jam, so we have to sort of cut her loose and... or... we find a way to use her skills for the good of all. I could totally see a version of that.
Put her in charge of the CIA.
Wouldn't Section 31 kill her, though? but anyway, yeah, I think that a lot of it will hinge on her. But is this definitely happening, this one?
It's in development.
Okay. In development. So I will kind of quietly root for this one to not happen.
But this is the fourth one,
but if it happens,
right?
I'm potentially open to it.
This is the fourth Trek project that
right.
They announced.
Yeah.
They have
Discovery,
five, right?
Discovery, Picard, animated show.
Okay.
This, and there's one more that we don't know about.
Yeah. Right, but that could be the one that was about Khan.
Oh, that is that's right. There's the Khan. So that is all five. Yeah.
Right, but like whether that'll I think they were unsure as to whether that was going to happen.
Yeah, these are all in development. None of them are guaranteed. Although I think the animated one is
the animated has gotten 2 seasons.
Hooray.
2 seasons. Goodness.
All right. The Invisibles is being adapted to TV by the same people who did Happy.
That Invisibles, for those who don't know, is a Grant Morrison long run series that went 50 issues, 40 issues?
Yeah, it's a ballpark. Sort of conspiracy...
trippy conspiracy theory that... this came out, the 90s?
Yeah.
That I know at least has some commonalities with The Matrix, because there were people who said that, like, they should sue over it. So it's clearly
Grant
has, like...
Morrison was one of those people.
Yeah, there was some, like, nested reality stuff.
I don't know. I read some of The Invisibles. I didn't see anything Matrix-like in it. I think he was reaching... I did not love The Invisibles. Nick, did you wind up reading it?
I read the first, trade or so, and I was not in love with it, but, again, I may have not been in the mood for
what it was. I think the lead character is something like freedom fighters / terrorists.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a feeling that when they adapt it, they will probably action it up a little bit and make it a little bit more mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
I actually feel like an adaptation could end up working. This is from somebody who also hasn't read it, but it's kind of just has some awareness of it. But I know that, Morrison, people don't, turn to him for, great action sequences, even though he writes some memorable action
he's
scenes.
He's the idea guy.
Yeah. But TV can do that very well, and so I would imagine them playing that up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I never finished Happy. I watched the first two episodes, and I was like, yeah, this is cool.
It was good. but I didn't wind up finishing it. All right, that's our news for the week. We are going to be back to talk about comics in just a minute.
One familiar cry. Rogue cast.
We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, November 14th. And Dave, why don't you start us off?
Sure. My choice is Firefly #1 from Boom Studios, a transition of to a different company formerly from Dark Horse, where Joss Whedon had kind of overseen it, occasionally written for it.
Yeah.
This one is written by Greg Pak, who most people know best for his Hulk work, like World War Hulk and Planet Hulk, iconic.
There's a ton of stuff at Boom too.
And a ton of other stuff. It's just the Hulk things is kind of remains is his. The biggest thing on his resume. The Dark Horse... So here's what I'll say is, Randy, I think you and I may have been on a similar position. Nick, I don't know where you stood on this. With licensed comics like this or Buffy, I don't always necessarily want them. I think sometimes the actors on those shows bring so much to the characters that it's hard to translate that to a comic. It can be fun to kind of revisit those characters, but, they're... It usually doesn't quite have the oomph of the show, and I end up slightly disappointed. Do you have that?
No, honestly.
No, I own all this Dark Horse stars.
Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually I agree with you on licensed projects like Buffy.
Yeah.
I feel like that suffered a lot.
Yeah, I fell off Buffy quite a bit.
But weirdly, Firefly is one of those where I feel like most of the comics that they've done have reached that goal.
They were definitely above average. I don't know. I think I bought about half of them.
I notably wanted the thing that it's notable to say that Boom has the Firefly license.
Yeah.
Dark Horse had the Serenity license.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference, because what we got from them was post movie stuff for the most part. We did get,
well, not for the most part, but that was just really towards
the
tail end.
It's about half and half. There's 6 volumes.
Okay.
The first three were there was a post Wash story, but there also was we got the origin of Book. We got, there was the Hands of Blue. It was sort of the transition between Firefly and Serenity.
Right.
And most of their stuff was sort of tail end or post-Serenity stuff. And I liked seeing what they were doing. I thought the stories were interesting. The problem I had was that I feel like the artist did not do likeness as well, and I couldn't always tell what was supposed to be going on.
Right.
But I really liked Tourney stuff, and as a result, I was curious to see what Pollock was going to do with Firefly, but I wasn't like, I don't know, I wasn't like jonesing for it.
Well, the interesting thing for me is I think I liked this over, at least at first blush, over the Dark Horse stuff.
There are a couple of exceptions for me. They did those Free Comic Book Day one-shots that were done by like Fabio Moon, and I forget who was writing them at that time.
Something about the one that was like the equivalent of Kitty's Fairy Tale from the X-Men, where Kitty is telling a story to
But they did
this
like
kid.
Two or three of them.
Yeah, yeah, they did.
And over the years, and I don't know if it ever got collected, but those are some of my favorites.
Yeah.
And but go on.
But as far as that, getting to the kind of core cast and do the characters feel right and all that stuff, I think first of all, just to address the likenesses thing, I think I like this. I like this artist over most of the Dark Horse artists.
This is other than Fabio Moon and Gabriel Ba, which I've forgotten. This is the best art that Firefly has had.
Chris Samnee worked on the Shepherd book one, I think,
that's right.
And he's a very talented artist. I think we were just a little disappointed in the story on that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to know. I know Dan McDade from something.
Yeah, he's done some stuff at Boom.
Yeah, I don't know quite how to describe him. He's not like a hyper-realistic artist, although there is some realism and detail. Like, as I'm skimming through this, there's lots of detail in the backgrounds that I really like, and like the ships and stuff all look cool. But the characters, his slightly stylish version of caricaturing really captures them, I think. There was never any doubt as to who's on screen. They're always kind of, the expressions, like, There's one where, like, Mal and Inara are kind of like, hey, we need to talk.
Yeah.
And they're kind of, his look of kind of, like, slightly doofus nobility.
Yeah.
And her kind of earnest gaze. And then they both kind of shift their eyes away from each other awkwardly. Was, like, I felt just dead on. And then there was a bunch of other ones like that.
He worked a lot at IDW. He's doing things like Planet of the Apes, which I remember him from now.
Okay.
Also, like, Doctor Who. He's worked at Image on a few things like Jersey Gods and Lost Vegas.
Well, this does open with a very Serenity movie thing where, like, the ship is on fire and there's a lot of banter going on.
Yep.
And there's some great banter.
It really is very good. He's like, the Mal goes up and he's like, is that the engine on fire? And Man Watch is like, no, it's all good. He's like, I mean, you're the pilot. I'm just the captain. I just have eyes to see the fire.
And they all get good moments. Like, Pac goes out of his way to establish all the characters pretty early on.
But that feels like a line that Nathan Fillion would deliver. Yeah. I mean, it's perfect.
Yeah.
I also love the coffee cup that Mal's walking around with. It says, best captain.
I hadn't seen that.
Which is fantastic.
Do we think that probably Kaylee got him that?
Probably.
Yeah, I would imagine.
It's almost got to be. But yeah, the whole scene, the opening sequence very deftly kind of reintroduces us to the cast.
Yep.
I feel that they don't tell us when this timeline, when this occurs, but the vibe I get is post the TV show, but before Serenity.
Yeah. Yes.
They mentioned something about Inara hoping to find a more stable, like a city or something to set up shop in. Like wanting to get off of the ship, as we would see happened in Serenity.
Yeah.
But it hasn't happened yet.
It's interesting, and I think this is a difference between Boom and Dark Horse, is that if Dark Horse were doing this, I think they would have called this Firefly Season 2. Because this very much is like what a Season 2 of Firefly would have looked like.
I think I kind of like the unofficial, not naming it like that.
I do too.
I'm not quite sure. I can't even quite say why I like it.
I agree with you. I think the less specificity is better in this case.
Yep. When I was doing my Star Trek podcast last night, I was talking about some of the novels that I read in the 80s. We were talking about whether people are prequeled out right now. You know, Solo kind of brought that up as a question, or like, are we kind of a little done with prequel stuff?
Yep.
And I was thinking, well, you know, those Star Trek books that I read in the 80s, some of which I really liked. I'm like, they were sort of lost adventures. I'm like, does that count as prequel stuff? At that point, they were onto the movies, and these were stories about them when they were younger. But I was like, no, it was more like just like a lost episode. And that's what this feels like, a lost episode.
Did you happen to read the afterword by Greg Pak?
The afterword where Pak sort of talks about how he was busy up on his full-on work. He was trying to turn it down. He had never seen Firefly. He'd only seen the movie.
Oh, my God.
He'd only seen Serenity.
The editor who he'd worked with was like, no, you will love Firefly. You should at least watch the pilot.
And then
he said, I watched the pilot, then I watched the rest of the episodes the next 24 hours and fell in love with it. And he's like, I have learned that when an editor I've worked with tells me that I should work on something to trust them. and as a result, he like fell in love with it. And then he decided to sort of went in. pitched him a story in sort of the, this would be fun, I'm not still not going to do it, but this would be interesting. And she's like, you're doing this, right? And he's like, yeah, I guess I am. But
that's
he pitches
great.
It, they pitched it as a 12-issue story, which I like that there's a little bit of a 12 issues.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Yep. That's a good long run, but maybe not like going forever, and I think that's interesting. So, yeah.
As I'm flipping through it, I noticed there's just tons and tons of dialogue bits that I like, much more than expected. There's kind of a situation that we're kind of familiar with, which is they're like super hardcore scrabbling for supplies and stuff, and they land on a planet, and they are going to have to like, they end up sort of getting involved in some local problems. I'm going to say, and it felt like it could have been an episode, but it's also something different from what we've seen before.
Yeah,
so I feel like they end on a good cliffhanger. I'm interested in where they're headed with it, and I feel it's a little hard for me to pin down quite why I felt like this over some of the Dark Horse ones. Maybe they just got a little familiar, but like I'm pretty excited for this. Honestly, I'll be hyped for the second issue and to see where they go.
All right, Nick.
I'm picking Wonder Woman number 58, which is essentially 58.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, it's been running for a while. It was a bi-weekly series.
Yeah, you know, DC's
thing. Yeah, right.
But yes, Wonder Woman 58, which is essentially a new number one in a lot of ways, because this is the start of G. Willow Wilson's run on this book. It's got beautiful artwork by Carrie Nord, if you remember.
I forgot it was Carrie Nord, but I was reading it.
If you remember Kurt Busiek's Conan.
Right, a legendary run.
Yeah, that's sort of where I first took note of Carrie Nord. And here, it's not as detailed as that, but
the coloring isn't as detailed because it's not like painty coloring.
Yeah.
But I feel like the art is still that recognizably that style.
Oh, it is, completely.
He's a guy who knows his way around drawing people with swords.
Yes. I mean, it makes sense. You draw Conan, you should draw Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And I was kind of unsure of where G. Will Wilson was just going to go, like maybe do her own thing, or if she was going to, you know, maybe tie in with other stuff. Mm-hmm. She's going the way of Grant Morrison did in Green Lantern, just coming up with her own story, but utilizing what's come before, because it sort of opens up with two characters, Ares and Grail, which is the daughter of Darkseid.
Yep. So that's clearly set in the present DC universe.
Yeah.
Ares has been like, well, they're both captured.
Yeah, they're both captured. They're both imprisoned, and they're
like
sort
below
of imprisoned.
Paradise Island, right?
Yeah, imprisoned together, and it's sort of them talking.
They hate each other.
They do hate each other. I actually thought the dialogue between the two characters was great.
If they had done a sitcom with the two of them buried underneath the Paradise Island, I would watch that.
And sort of something big occurs. I don't want to spoil it.
But it comes out of Ares recognizing kind of a flaw in his philosophy of like, he's talking about how like, you know, I used to think like the conquerors were who lived on in legends, but he starts naming some famous conquerors of old, and he's like, nobody remembers this guy anymore, but he once ruled like all of ancient Greece or whatever, and you know, he's like, so what is it actually that I want, or what can really, you know, how do you become?
And he comes to this new realization.
He comes to a new realization that sets him on an interesting and weird path.
Yeah, and then we sort of get to Diana and Wonder Woman, and sort of her having this premonition of Steve Trevor in trouble.
Yep.
Which is also, I thought, was a great little two-page scene of what it would be like if, you know, Steve Trevor was constantly in her life.
Right.
And then it cuts to sort of a conversation between Diana and Etta Candy, which is like...
Their Etta Candy was weird. Is that a New 52 thing?
I believe she's always been a part of Steve Trevor's sort of military unit. I mean,
she's kind of attaché, but now it seems like she's
like a commander, which is an interesting continuation. Or I don't remember this version.
Right.
But I liked the version because it was an interesting juxtaposition from what we see in like the Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah.
By the way, there's some real energy in that helicopter panel shot there that shows her. But basically, she gets in touch with Wonder Woman, and she tells her, like, look, something happened that Steve might be missing, and we're investigating.
But we don't want you involved.
Yeah, you just so you know.
And that's like, that's not something that Wonder Woman is capable of not getting involved in.
I kind of like when they see each other later on. She's like, I told you not to get involved, and she's like, you did tell me that, or something like that.
And then, of course, there's other things afoot. I mean, Steve Trevor's captured, but there's more larger godlike things happening around, and Nord's action is fantastic. I actually
she
really...
uses her whip. She uses her lasso as a sort of whip and, like, shears off the end of all these, like, assault rifles that are trained on her. And it looks really cool. It's like she just, like, chops them all to pieces.
Yeah, the action is great. And I actually think G. Willow Wilson has got a great handle on Wonder Woman.
I like her too.
What makes her tick.
She reminded me of the kind of a little bit of the no-nonsense version from the movie, which I think is a good version to use as a keynote. But she is a woman of action.
Yep. And I mean that's
and peace too. But
definitely action.
Yeah. When she's drawn into a wartime scenario, she's going to have some. At one point, she's like she says something like, "Is there no you know one who brings? Is there no honor at all in you know wartime?"
Yeah. As troops are about to fire on just a mother and child.
Right.
Yeah. It's sort of this what defines Wonder Woman,
and
I think that definition is needed, and it's a good exclamation point for her first issue.
Yep.
And there's a lot of like mysteries here on what exactly is happening, and I liked that. And
yes, the threads with Ares, threads with Steve Trevor, and
threads with her
overstepping her bounds in like a foreign country, a war in a foreign country.
Yeah, I just felt it was like it had everything I wanted out of a first issue,
including, by the way, a nice cover from Terry Dodson's there.
Yeah, well, and he's not unknown to do great Wonder Woman covers. He did a lot of.
Well, he did some good ones. I thought he did pretty good.
No, I'm saying he's known to be doing good.
Oh, sorry, I thought you said he's not known or something.
Yeah, he's known.
And I kind of liked him.
You put it in a confusing way, Nick.
Yes, I did. He did a ton for the like Gail Simone's run, if I'm not mistaken, and the Alan Heinberg run.
So that's a pretty good package team, that, as it turns out. I like this issue a lot, too, and it was one of my considerations for my
picks. But then I was like,
week.
No, it is mine.
Oh, that's
and then
all
I
right.
punched him.
It's all right.
So my pick, nobody fought me over. I don't know if anybody else read it. It's an image book called The Terrible Elizabeth Dunn Against the Devils in Suits.
Which is a great title.
Yeah. I do like the title.
This is it looks like a European comic. It was,
It's tall.
Script and art is by someone named Arabson. It was adapted by James Robinson. And it is a story of a man who is greeted by the devil in his house late at night, and it's been 20 years... And he is trying to become a godly man, but he made a deal with the devil for his firstborn son, and he doesn't want to give up his son now. So instead, he offers up his daughter, who has become a hellion, who he sent off to a boarding school because she's just a nightmare. And he's trying to get the devil to take his daughter instead. And this hellion daughter is not taking it lying down. She meets up with this musician who has also made a deal with the devil for his music, and they have to basically battle a hellhound and save her soul. It's strange and fun and has this spectacular artwork.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. Its oversized nature is a very nice fit with that artwork.
In fact, the only gripe I have about it is it feels like it didn't end. It kind of feels like, oh, I would have liked to have seen this stretched out over a longer story. I would like to see like the first chapter of this and see more. Now it's a Eurograph novel, which makes me think there's probably more to it. But It's a really good. I like all the character designs. I like sort of their mythology, which reminds me a little bit of what goes on, like sort of Supernatural, with people making deals with devils at the crossroads. There's some music in the mix. There's some great action. I definitely recommend this as sort of a weird offbeat comic for the week. My backup pick for the week is the second part of Spider-Man vs. Moreland Round 3. This is a Peter Parker, Spectacular Spider-Man number 312, Sean Ryan writing. It is, Spidey is getting his butt kicked because Moreland showed up and smashed his dimension thing and he can't flee him. So Miles Morales shows up to back him up, as does J. Jonah Jameson. And it is basically another big fight of Spidey fighting a guy who he knows he can't beat and trying to figure out what to do about it. It definitely makes Moreland a really bad guy. It's a good reason for why Peter Parker is not heavily involved in Spider-Geddon. It's got some great Miles stuff. It's got some great J. Jonah stuff. I definitely recommend it.
Peter Parker or Spider-Man will never go up into a battle against Moreland and not get his suit shredded.
Yeah, that's
that
that's
dude will trash
does.
Him every time.
Yes, that's very true.
Dave, what's your backup?
My backup is issue number 4 of Jeff Lemire's series, The Quantum Age, his Legion of Superheroes type book.
That character on the front covers, it looks like she's about to just wreck somebody.
Yes, well, she's a little bit of like, Randy, did she play the role, you would say, of Supergirl in this future?
She's Hammerlass.
She's Hammerlass. Yeah. And she looks like it was cast as Janelle Monáe.
A little bit.
Yeah. She's got the tall hair and kind of stylish look. And what happens is kind of you see about how she came into her Hammer heritage.
Yep.
In this one.
Her Hammeritage.
Her Hammeritage. And how it leads them to the place they are right now with her and a couple of other misfits from the... I forget, Randy, who this guy actually is
He's a Martian.
That's right. He was kind of... And he's been kind of the gathering force between them.
Yeah.
So it's sort of four misfits from sort of their Legion of Superheroes type thing. Trying to get to the bottom of a mystery involving what was it? Like their time travel enemy, their equivalent of a time trapper is like Chronicus.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a big reveal at the end of this that ties it all the way back to Black Hammer in a really cool way and makes me like super excited for the next issue. But there's also a lot of cool character stuff. There's her kind of the same way Supergirl had a thing with Brainiac 5, Hammerlass had a thing with Archive 5, and their moments together when he's like essentially been kind of like stored in a computer bank and given up all his humanity to just become part of their sort of hive mind of knowledge.
Yeah.
And she's sort of trying to coax him out. And as always, Lemire kind of takes these like larger than life concepts and, you know, can make it about two characters who fell out of love and need to sort of maybe rediscover each other and tell a compelling and touching story about that. But I will say the thing I'm most interested in is the big plot reveal at the end because it was super cool. Anyway, it's obviously Legion of Superheroes fans should probably be reading this. And if you're reading any of the Black Hammer stuff, you should be reading all of the Black Hammer stuff.
Agreed. Nick, your backup?
Yes, my backup pick is Fantastic Four number 3. I mean, we've seen this kind of get delayed for a little while, but honestly, I think it was definitely... I'm very pleased with the... It's just a fun book. I think Dan Slott has a great handle on the characters. I love that it's a 3-issue story arc. I mean, that's sort of complete kind of their first story.
4-issue story arc.
No, you don't want to just do that. You don't want to run into that. But this is sort of Reed and his family versus this sort of person who's supposed to be the end of the Fantastic Four. And it's typical Reed coming up with ways to beat her while involving all the characters and his family, reuniting. I love the scene with Valeria and Johnny and Ben and, Franklin.
Are you telling me that all the characters are in the same place at the same time?
I am saying that. It's actually heartfelt. Dan Slott does a great job with it.
Nice.
The action is great. Honestly, I mean, this is what I want from an FF book. And I am looking forward to seeing what Dan Slott goes with as things moving forward. Also, I love seeing a lot of the smaller characters that show up. Like, the FF, the Future Foundation characters like Dragon Man. But there's also,
I was
like,
hoping when you say smaller characters show up like Ant-Man.
No, he just utilizes all the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, yeah, Dragon Man last seen kind of notably in Hickman's run.
Yep. I think if you love the FF, you should be reading this.
What else is on your stack for the week?
The final issue of Cosmic Ghost Rider before he shows back up in the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
It was a fun conclusion to his story of Cosmic Ghost Rider and Thanos.
Thanos.
Well, no, he's grown Thanos now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's time travel involved.
Okay.
And then, it goes into some bizarre places. I didn't get to read it, but the 5th issue of Captain America, which I've been enjoying, which has Captain America going up against Selene from the X-Men, which is bizarre, but I like it. Jason Aaron's 7th issue of Thor, which continues to be fantastic. Venom number 8, which sees sort of Venom or Eddie Brock with kind of a lesser symbiote as he's dealing with the evil Reed Richards, which is still
a symbiote named Frank.
Yes. Supergirl number 24, which is sort of the continuation of her
space adventures,
trying to figure out who Rogal Zar was, and was he in fact responsible for destroying Krypton. She does meet up with some cool characters. There's more adventures with Crypto. Some great action. This is drawn by Evan Shaner, so it's fantastic. And just a great cover by Amanda Connor with Supergirl and Crypto sitting in a bar.
Yep.
An alien bar. The Black Order number one sees the kind of force that was the army of Thanos kind of on their own, working for a elder of the universe, causing chaos. It was fun. It was kind of an interesting look at some of these characters and how they viewed themselves. Like, kind of interesting in the fact that they've never had really great personalities.
Right. They're very devoted to Thanos, and they destroy people.
So having Corvus Glaive trying to be funny and trying to understand what humor is was kind of cool. I don't know who this writer Derek Landy is, but it's a great start. And Philip Tan
does
some good art.
What's his deal with airline peanuts? Die!
And then, of course, the final issue of Mr. Miracle, which ends interestingly enough, as you might expect. But
is it one of those that you'll have to ponder a little bit?
I have to ponder.
Okay.
Yeah, it is one of those ponder
I didn't figure songs. It was going to end and suddenly have just like 80 explanations for kind of everything going
on.
No,
this one is definitely different than that.
All
so
right, well, it's pondersome.
Yes.
Dave, what else is on your stack?
Latest issue of Gideon Falls has a really cool storyline. That's Jeff Lemire's suspense supernatural book. Hawkman number 6 continues the Hawkman Adam team up on another world, and was another really really cool kind of very action oriented outing on this one between the two of them. There's a Dr. Horrible one-shot from Dark Horse.
I really like that.
Yeah, I was flipping through it and it looked good. For fans of the Life is Strange video game, you know, sort of in the style of those Telltale games, should check it out. There's a what looks to be a very faithful sort of follow-up from as a comic. It's just literally just called Life is Strange. They kind of combine sort of slice of life stuff with a little bit of a psychic sort of time-bending element. There's a new book from Image called Bitter Root. Randy, you can remind me. The creative team is straight
they
off
did
of
Power Man and Iron Fist.
Power Man and Iron Fist, really really awesome artwork, and it's a story of a sort of African American monster hunting family in like the 1920s, kind of circa the Harlem Renaissance.
Yeah.
And of kind of the vibe I got flipping through it was they have the larger than life personalities of almost like Doc Savage's crew.
Yeah.
But as a dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
And then lastly, I wanted to mention the Alien 3 miniseries. This is not Alien 3, the David Fincher version that you saw in the theater and then wept afterwards, but rather an adaptation of an unproduced screenplay from William Gibson, a.k.a. one of the great, you know, fathers of cyberpunk who wrote Neuromancer and all that. And it's an alternate version that does in fact include... does not kill off in the opening credits Hicks and Newt and Bishop and all of those. Does not take them out of the picture and has them in there. So if you're interested to see this possible alternate vision of what could have been, definitely check it out.
All right. Let's see. For me, I got Daredevil 611, which is part 3 of The Death of Daredevil. Has some pretty notable stuff in it. Ms. Marvel number 36, which is sort of a weird sort of what-if story about Miss Marvel as a princess in Constantinople in 1257 AD.
That's interesting.
It was an interesting one-shot. Domino number 8, which has a really cool take on Morbius, and has Domino and her crew dealing with vampires. Vault of Spiders number 2, which has 3 new Spider-Man alternates, including the creepy what-if a hive of radioactive spiders became Spider-Man.
Ah, it's like Swarm, the Nazi B-Man, but
it's
with spiders.
Creepy. Unstoppable Wasp number 2. Bloodshot Rising Spirit number 1, which is the basically the origin of Bloodshot. Star Trek Transformers number 2, which is weird and fun.
Oh, I forgot to read that.
And then the latest issue of a few Image books. Juke Joint number 2, Murder Falcon number 2, and Skyward number 8. And finally, I wanted to mention two things. Three things from the collection world. Dr. Star and the Kingdom of Lost Tomorrows is the sort of Starman analog from the world of Black Hammer. As Dave said, if you're reading any Black Hammer, you should read all Black Hammer. And if you're not reading any Black Hammer, Why aren't you reading Black Hammer? Black Hammer's great.
It is great.
Also want to mention the hardcover of Rat Queens Volume 2 finally out, and the library oversized edition of Harrow County, the spooky story of witches from Cullen Bunn and Dark Horse that I'm super excited to finally see a big hardcover version of. That is it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and I'll definitely have a report for you from BGGCon of a bunch of board games. And until that time,
Yo Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.